Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, I'm John Mayhead. I write about cars. And I've up until this point, I've been writing for various different magazines. Most people know me from talking about data stories and all that sort of thing, which I do a lot for Haggerty. And that's why I came on a couple of years ago and we talked about that side of things. And I've just written my first book about a racing driver. And that's why I'm on today.
The Driven Chat Podcast, powered by Paramex Digital.
Hello and welcome to the latest Driven Chat podcast. My name is John Markar, and sat just next to me
Hello,
is
I'm Amy Haynes, nearly normal now. And in front of us, we have the lovely John Mayhead that you just heard about. Hey. So welcome. Thanks for coming to our little office.
Thanks for having me again.
No, it's lovely. It's you dropped me a message a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about books and stuff and events, and I'm trying to make a book and it's not happening, and you're trying to be very helpful and I keep ignoring all your messages. and then you said, oh, by the way, I've just got this new book. And I said, oh, this sounds interesting. Let's have a chat. So thanks for coming along.
Yeah, thank you for having me. No, it's great to be able to talk about it, really, at last, because it's been quite a long time in the offing, and with lots of like lockdowns and God knows what else happened to sort of delay everything. But it's at the printers at the moment. We've got the cover in front of us.
We have.
Which is hot off the press. And it'll be out at the end of the month, so it's very exciting.
Yeah, this is very, very exciting. Because we don't really, in the grand scheme of things, I think back to all the conversations we've had, journalists, writers, car designers, video makers, film directors, we haven't really had that many books to push. I can probably count on one hand how many books
I can only think of one, and that it was the chap with the James Bond
ones. Oh yeah, Ben Robinson.
Yes,
I
can't remember.
Gosh,
you and I did like 4 podcasts that day. We drove a really long way for that one. Something like that.
We
remember being tired.
We started our day in the Midlands, went to Putney to record with Collecting Cars, then went down to, I don't know, quiet corner of Surrey. But we also had Philippa Sage, who wrote a book about Jeremy Clarkson.
Of course, oh, yes.
There's probably more. Oh, no, they're all coming back to me now. Brian Klein, Top Gear director, he's done 2 books, so I've talked to him twice about those.
Still, of everything, there's not very many book writers in there. We've had a lot more racing drivers than authors, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're one of few. You're
Thank an, you very
you're
much.
A very exclusive.
Yeah,
club.
Very exclusive club.
I feel we should actually reference the fact that it is your second time here, yeah. And because the last time you were on, believe it or not, the episode that we recorded with you proved to be one of our most popular downloads in a very, very short space of time, because I think people, there's a lot of people out there who perhaps, whilst I'm quite happy to admit that I'm a massive nerd, a lot of people out there aren't as vocal about it, but secretly like to do all sorts of analytic discoveries and have these discussions and listen in on these discussions. And of course, the last time you were on, so saying this for the benefit of the listener who might not have heard your previous episode with us, where you came on with the most amazing job title I could possibly ever think
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
Let me see if it's going to come back to me. Head of Automotive Intelligence.
Yeah, Head of Automotive Intelligence.
That's
UK.
A real title.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really cool. It's so basically it's valuations, yeah. And so Haggerty, big insurance company, 2 million classic cars, but we also track everything else. So we track auction results, we track dealer results, we speak to people, and what we do is, you know, I'm a nerd like you, so I love drawing down into what happens, you know, why do some people buy certain cars and not other ones? Why do some cars go up in value and not other ones? And we can look into stuff that other people can't. So the demographics, how old somebody is when they buy a car, what do they buy the next car? You know, what trading up and all of this. And so, yeah, I find that fascinating and I'm glad other people do as well.
Yeah.
And they seem to read the stories we produce, which is great. And I love talking about that sort of thing.
Yeah. And you're still there. You're still doing the same role.
Absolutely. Yep. So still, managing Automotive Intelligence, which is
still shattering dreams.
Shattering dreams. Yeah. But it's a great job, actually. Haggerty's great. It's a great place. Still got that feeling of real enthusiasm, the people that work there. Since we last spoke, I've got a chief analyst of Automotive Intelligence in the UK called Richard, who is absolutely brilliant, and he's great at digging even further than I am into, goes beyond spreadsheets. So he goes into the real depths, and then he'll come out and he'll say, "This is interesting," and I'll go, "Oh yeah, it really is interesting," and then I'll try and sort of write about it or talk about it and get it out there, which is quite key, because you can get the kind of analytical bit and you can make something, you can find something which I find interesting, but it's actually translating that into something which a lot of people can understand and find interesting.
Amazing.
I think.
And is that the kind of the intricate level of 100 of these cars produced, but these ones that have green over tanned leather, or is it that level of intricacy? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah. Interestingly, he worked for a major performance car producer, manufacturer before us, and he was looking into all of those sort of things. So, which wheels were better for resale, which interior extras and options, and all that sort of thing. So, he we can really dial down into these things, and it's all the interesting cars. We deal with classic cars because that's what we're known as, classic car insurer, but also all the performance cars as well, which. Yeah. Modern performance cars are doing a lot of stuff with those at the moment.
I love it. I love it. Love all this stuff. I'm currently selling this is not a sales plug, I should point out, but it enabled me to do a little bit of reading and research, which was quite cathartic. I'm selling a Z3 M Coupe, which is a different one to the white one that I had before. This is a black one. And I thought, I'm going to have a quick look because somebody or a collection of people perhaps on the internet have gone to the extent of... And this is quite a common thing with BMW M cars, especially of the kind of the millennial era, so late 90s, early noughties, where people have actually done the legwork and found out every single colour combination.
Yeah.
Wheels, colour, leather trim. And they've itemised out every single colour combination and exactly to the exact number how many cars were produced in that specification in the world. So I was delighted to discover that my Cosma Schwartz over Carl Army interior Z3 M Coupe is one of only 29 in the world.
Oh, wow.
Jumped for joy.
You see, I love, yeah. That's why I love a German motor manufacturers. Yes. Yeah. You can do that.
Yeah.
You know, I've got an old camper van, 1970 VW, and it's got a plate behind the seat, which tells you exactly what extras it was made with. My background's in Alphas from the 50s, 60s. Yeah. They didn't know what came out of that factory. You know, they would, you know, there are no, all these things about, you know, old Alphas having matching number engines. It's just ridiculous. Yes. And Alpha didn't know what number the engine was, let alone, you know, what colour it was. I mean, it was, you
know, it's so true, though, isn't it? You lift up the bonnet on most Porsche products and there's an actual paper stuck on sticker that looks like it was probably only designed to be there for a week.
Yeah.
But yet it's there with all the different codes of this option, this option, this paint, this leather. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. Thank you, Germany. Thank you, Germany, for appeasing our slightly bizarre brains. Let's definitely talk about this book because it's very exciting. And the fact that you have had quite a busy, intriguing, involving day job. I know, I mean, I've not written a book myself, but I have spoken to plenty of people that have, and I know that it's quite a time-intensive process, isn't it, with regards to research and reading and then writing and thinking about layouts and all that sort of stuff. How, with a full-time job as busy as yours, do you also get the time to write quite a comprehensive book?
I started before I was full-time is the first first thing. So I used to be freelance for Haggerty, and I started this back in 2018, and it was an accidental kind of start because I was writing a story about the Jaarbeke speedruns in near Ostend in Belgium for Haggerty, and this guy Goldie Gardner just popped out as being this really extraordinary person. And I couldn't really find out anything about him. And so started the research then, found out the National Motor Museum had 35 boxes of his stuff. So got in amongst all of that, then started buying old books. And then the lockdown happened and I went from, and then I came on full time with Haggerty about 2 or 3 years ago. And then lockdown happened and it was just, you know, I think as a lot of people had, you maybe had a bit more time to do other stuff. And I would go and lock myself, I've got an office in the garden, go and lock myself in there and go and write. It helps me calm down. I love writing and I write in the evenings and I write at weekends. And I've got a very patient wife who would let me go away from the kids for a bit just to give me some sort of headspace. And then after lockdown lifted, again, she would let me. So I would go away on a Friday evening, go to a pub, stay overnight, write all day and then come back. And it's just kind of putting it together. But for me, it is very therapeutic, the whole thing. It's been a real labor of love. This guy, I've discovered so much, and also I've met so many different people involved in his life and all their families, and it's been brilliant, including, you know, your husband.
Yes.
And the link there.
That was the thing. So yesterday we got your kind of a preview of your book, and so I had a quick skim through. I mean, mainly I was interested in the photographs, let's be honest.
Yeah.
So and I was like, oh my goodness, I had no idea that there was that kind of that link really to Lofty England, and I've forgotten who else was in the photograph. But anyway, the kind of the XK link to start. So I was so I said to William, I was like, did you know about this guy? And he was like, absolutely not. So I think this should be the point where, John Marker, you use your amazing voiceover voice to read it, because otherwise people are not going to really know what we're on about. And I think this is the most amazing introduction to a book that I've ever read.
Okay, I'm going to do my best here, dear listener. And
have you read through it at all?
I have read through it once. And if this sounds perfectly voiced, like I've read it for the first time, then it might be because I re-recorded it after this initial recording, but we'll see. I should also point out that what I'm reading this from is essentially it's the test print, isn't it, of your front cover?
Yeah, it's the proof of the dust jacket for the...
Which is very exciting. So this would be the inside fold.
It would.
Yeah, you turn the hardback, but right, it's very exciting. Okay, I'm going to have a go. Dear listener. Massive title on the front, Goldie, which of course refers to this. But how's this for a grabbing headline? Unfeasible speed, disgruntled Nazis, beautiful heiresses. Pretty good start, isn't it? If that hasn't grabbed you, I don't know what will. Here we go. For the tall, strong and determined Alfred Goldie Gardner, the transition from rugby captain to British Army officer at the outbreak of the First World War was a natural one. He thrived in the trenches of the Somme, quickly being promoted and decorated for bravery. Then, in the summer of 1917, everything changed. A bad decision and a harsh twist of fate led to a terrible wound that left his life altered beyond recognition. Without the sports and motorcycling that dominated his youth, and only able to walk with the aid of a stick, he searched for a new direction in life. He found it on the banked concrete of Brooklands and the blackthorn-lined racing circuits of Ireland. With the exhilaration of motor racing came camaraderie and a sense of purpose once again. But it was record-breaking that came to define him, prompting adventures around the world where he found love and national recognition, but also betrayal and loss. Finally, his obsessive attainment of speed records led to his own downfall and almost destroyed his family. Goldie is the true story of Goldie Gardner, the most prolific speed record holder there has ever been. With a supporting cast of daredevil aristocrats, ingenious engineers and beautiful heiresses, this biography tracks his extraordinary life from the cold showers of his private school to his death in 1958. It's a story of unfeasible speeds, records snatched from disgruntled Nazis and secret wartime missions, but also of the deep human connections he made along the way. Until now, that story remained untold.
Ooh. I can already imagine it being a film directed by Christopher Nolan. And
well, you know,
and,
yeah. I'm not saying that we've already got the cast ready in my head anyway.
I mean, I watched Oppenheimer at the weekend and I can see this being the next thing really that he does. So, yeah. Yeah. Do we know any links to Christopher? Chris?
Don't look at me. I'll see if he follows me on Instagram. No, he doesn't. But yeah, I mean, yeah, that is quite the grab, isn't it? It does sound like it should be a film already.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes, it does.
It definitely, in the meantime, makes me want to read the book, which is, of course, why we're here.
So, I mean, this sounds such an incredible story. How do you, and you said, you know, I'd never heard of Goldie until you got through your book. And when you said that you hadn't ever heard of him either.
Yeah.
How is somebody this awesome kind of lost to history?
It's a really good question. And it is, he was... you have to kind of know a bit of his story, but he was quite a big deal pre-Second World War, where he beat some extraordinary records. And he did it in a very, you know, as I said, in sort of in Germany, with surrounded by the Silver Arrows, you know, state-sponsored teams, and they were, and he turned up in what was essentially kind of his own car with a bit of support from MG, and broke records and took them home, and they were astounded. And he was, you know, in a time where you know, the national sort of support for somebody like this waving the British flag was extraordinary. So he did really well. And then after the Second World War, he went straight back into it. But times had changed and he was getting on, you know. He was born in 1890. So by the time he was breaking records after the Second World War, all the new generation of people were turning up. So you had these really glamorous people like Peter Collins and Stirling Moss and you know, on their brand new cars. And then you had this guy with his old pre-war car who was rolling out. He was, you know, nearing his 60s. And he was kind of just a bit forgotten about. And then the thing that really made him made him die in the public consciousness was the fact that he didn't die in a massive ball of flames and he didn't survive. He got whacked on the, he got hit on the head in an accident with a marker post, hit him on the head. And it was a very... it was a very kind of small injury, but actually it caused hemorrhage and then he degenerated over years and years. And so he kind of faded away rather than, you know, he didn't do a Donald Campbell and he didn't stay around. And he was forgotten about, really. And also he was not a showman. Mm-hmm. Malcolm Campbell was one of his closest friends, and he was his Goldie worked as his kind of manager for the 1935 Daytona Beach land speed record attempt. And, you know, he was, I said in an article recently, he was a sort of yin to Malcolm Campbell's yang, whereas, you know, Malcolm Campbell's this amazing showman who would always make the most out of everything, and Goldie really didn't. And if you see him on, there's old film footage of him, he has this resting, like, furious face. He has this, like, he's like this, you look at him and it's like, my God, you wouldn't go near him. And when he's on camera, he's just not interested. He's awful wow. on camera. And the combination of those two things mean that most of the photographs, I mean, there was one I found on, I think is one on Wikipedia, and he's like glaring at the camera. And it's only when you see him with his, with the mechanics and with the friends, where you see the real him, which is where he's much more relaxed and much more open. And so it was, you know, he just wasn't very good at the whole publicity thing.
Not a great PR machine.
No. although it was really interesting because he also kept huge records of everything he did. So he, even from the 30s, early 30s, he'd paid for clipping services, which were these companies that would take clippings from any newspaper and magazine all over the world and send them to you. And so boxes of his stuff at Bewley are clippings from wow. everywhere around the world. And some of them are still in the envelopes. They're just wadges wow. of these clippings about everything he did. So he was obviously proud of what he did.
Yeah.
But he wasn't good at getting out there and selling his story, which was an extraordinary story.
Absolutely. So how did you discover him? How did it get to a point where you had that little light bulb that went, hang on, why isn't anyone talking about this guy?
Oh, it was completely by accident. I was going to a friend's wedding in Holland with my wife in 2018, and I was freelance, so I was thinking, oh, what else could I do on that side of the channel which I could, you know,
get a day rate for.
Exactly, yeah. So, and I'd heard of this place called Jaarbekker, which is a dead straight piece of motorway just outside Ostend, where after the Second World War there were lots of speed records, and there were loads of sort of famous people that went there. So Stirling Moss drove there, Sheila Van Damme, they tested, Norman Jewis tested XK120 there, and so I went there, I found it, there's still a bit left next to the big motorway, and I wrote this article for Haggerty, and this guy who found it was this 6'3" disabled war veteran who stuck out the top of his car and drove extraordinary speeds there. And I thought, God, he sounds interesting. Also, because I used to be in the army, it was of interest to me. I tried to find out more about him, and other than a few magazine articles and a really, at that point, really bad Wikipedia page, there was nothing out there. And the last book to be written about him was his own autobiography in 1951.
That's interesting. So, I mean, you've now written a biography about
yeah.
him. Does it differ much from his autobiography? Is there a bit you found out and you're like, actually,
oh,
I've...
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, so his autobiography is very... it's very detailed. So it is... I went this speed, and then I went 1.1 of a mile an hour on the return journey, and then I, you know, et cetera, et cetera. He completely glosses over something. So his whole First World War experience, which was extraordinary, is dealt with in two sentences. And there's interesting reasons behind that. He doesn't talk about anything really in the Second World War. I mean, he talks about the sort of, I went here and I was posted here and I was posted here, but he crossed the beaches on D-Day with, what? You know, in Montgomery's staff. And he was involved in this amazing things called the Coates Mission to evacuate the royal family from London should the Germans invade. But I think at the time it's probably still secret. Yeah. That's why he didn't talk about that. And then it stopped because he wrote it up to 1950, and then 51, 52 were the last two Bonneville runs. So none of that is in there. But I've tried to make mine a story that can be enjoyed by more people than just pure petrol heads. Mm-hmm. Whereas his was more of a detailed sort of analysis of what he did for the records. Mm.
I had a really good question. That's completely gone because I was interested in listening to what you were saying. So, no, I've gone.
I find the whole, it must be a generational thing with the guys and girls that served in World War One, World War Two, who just don't seem, that storytelling now from recent operations, wars, battles, everyone wants to tell their story. But what's interesting is you hear about these people that, you know, have been through incredible chapters like D-Day landings and not wanting to tell that story. And I guess there are going to be many, many, many complex reasons as to why certain people don't want to do it. You know, I think back to my grandfather, who had some quite interesting roles in the Second World War. And it wasn't really until his much, much, much later years that he started talking about some of them. And I guess that's because of harbouring, you know, difficult memories and certain things that perhaps you're not that proud of, actually. Mm. You were doing the right thing for the right people, but ultimately the things you did weren't that great.
Yeah.
So it is fascinating to discover that people lived through these amazing stories and wrote an autobiography, but didn't really talk about it.
So that was my question. It was an obvious one. How on earth did he find out this information, especially as he died so long ago? And I don't know if he's, you know, if he... I mean, he must have either spoken to some people about some of those things that went on, or if he couldn't speak about them at the time, then I can't imagine he wrote these things down, or maybe he did write diaries that have been found. How on earth did you find all of this, all these amazing stories and bits of information out?
His wife, Una, who he married just before the Second World War, was meticulous about keeping things, and she donated pretty much his whole collection to the National Motor Museum about 25 years ago, maybe a bit longer than that, actually. But there's tons and tons and tons in there. So there's lots of photography. He was a keen amateur photographer, so there's lots of his own photographs. He annotates a lot of them. He kept lots of records, but then lots of it has been going down different routes. So... for me, I think one of the best things about writing this book was that I love kind of, you know, I love working out the story and researching. And so there were some MG historians, some fantastic MG historians who helped me. They gave me access to loads of letters from the factory back in the day. So you can kind of see sometimes both sides of the letters, which was really good. So there's one archive that I had, and then you've got the other archive in the National Motor Museum and of the other, you know, the response to the letter.
So you could find each letter from each side and like kind of put it in a timeline of back and forth and back and forth.
Other things were, so the mission, the Coates mission, was from a few photographs in the National Motor Museum, which nobody knew what they were. It was just him and Malcolm Campbell stood next to a load of racing cars with a load of military police people in the early days of the Second World War, but that was it. And then you have to kind of put them all together, because then I then got in touch with the military police and they had their archive and they knew roughly what had happened with the Coates mission. James Coates, the guy who was in charge of it, was in the Coldstream Guards, which is what I was in. So there was that element to it. And then there was these letters from the Reigate Auxiliary Police Force saying to Gardner, you know, thanks for doing what you did in the war. It was awesome. And then we started to sort of work out what had happened. And there's still elements of that, which, again, that would be another amazing film. But so we know that Malcolm Campbell was put in charge of this group of military police. He hired all the TT riders and all the sort of like what would now be MotoGP riders, gave them all performance bikes, and they were his group to get the Royals out.
Outriders.
Wow. Outriders. Well. But what we didn't know was, and then there was this group of, there were four racing drivers. So there's a picture with him, Goldie Gardner, AFP Fain, and one other who I can't identify yet because he's too far away, all next to their racing cars. And the Coates mission, basically what happened was, is there were four stately homes across the north of England. And in the middle of the night, you know, Germans invaded, royal family get in cars and bikes and they go. And what we think was happening was that, you got one to each because there were four and there were four. And so they'd all bomb us and nobody would know which ones the real royal family were in. And that's what I think was going on. But he, the fact that he hired these racing drivers he knew.
That's wicked.
Which was awesome. So you know, this middle of that. It's a bit of a shame it didn't happen.
Well, yeah.
You know?
That is a film. Right yeah. There. That's a book. That's a film. That's a Netflix series.
I mean, it would be awesome but if it had happened. That's the only thing. So, but it didn't. And then he ended up being posted to Scarborough in charge of the MT, which was the sort of like driver training for the Royal Artillery.
Wow.
But then even that, he got bored of that, and then he volunteered for something. And that's how he ended up doing the D-Day thing.
I mean, could you imagine anything similar happening modern day? Charles Leclerc, George Russell, Lewis Hamilton. One's got William, one's got Charles, one's got Camilla.
It's fantastic.
Valentino
isn't it?
Rossi is an outrider. Peter Hickman's at the back on his on his Aprilia. Wow.
So there was all of that, and that was before we even scratched the surface of his racing and his, and also all the backstory for me, which I found really interesting, was how much the First World War and his experience of the First World War really shaped his whole life, as it did, I think, for a lot of those record breakers and racers from Brooklands, that Brooklands era. And pretty much all of them didn't have a particularly, in what they would see, a good First World War. You know, it all ended a bit kind of strangely.
Yeah, it was a bit shambolic. Really, yeah,
well, it was almost a personal thing. So for Gardner, he did really, really well in the First World War. He was very well regarded as an officer. He was given command very early, even though he wasn't a career officer. He was given mentioned in dispatches. He won the Military Cross, which was third highest award for bravery. And then suddenly in the summer of 1917, he was involved in this air crash, which basically, you know, just pretty much destroyed his leg and almost, it was almost amputated, but he walked with a stick ever after that. And it led to him being discharged as unfit for military service in 1921. And so many of the others of that era also had issues with how they left. And it was as if they were getting together at Brooklands, both for camaraderie, but also to prove themselves to their country, because then, you know, there were these daredevils who were doing stuff for their country and bringing national recognition. And it was almost as like, oh, I couldn't finish off the job I was doing in the trenches, so I'm now doing it now. And that led straight into record breaking, where it was just that they were.
So he did all of his record breaking with a dodgy leg.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, and it got worse because in 1932 he was racing in the Ulster TT and he had a horrendous crash in a C-type, MG C-type midget, and it rolled and actually landed on his leg on his bad one again and completely crushed it again, hip and there was, so he spent another 3-4 months in Newton Arts Hospital, and he said that the consultant used to turn up and tweak his toe, and he used to think, why is he doing that? And it was to see if it basically all the nerves had died, and if it had, leg would have come off, but it didn't. He could walk even worse after that, and then he started record breaking because he thought it was less dangerous activity than road racing, which probably was, but I sort of see
the logic. Yeah, what's interesting is, do you think the record breaking for him personally was a task, you know, something to do and achieve? Because as you say, he clearly wasn't a showman. He wasn't out there to wave his own flag and tell everyone how brilliant he was. So do you think it was perhaps, because I guess there would have been various mental restraints to getting in a racing car and competing, not being at the peak of your physical fitness. You know, any single one of us that has any form of day job, we know when we're not on our best form, and therefore we might not have our best performance that day. We might not be able to do our job to our best ability. So I can imagine he, in an environment of looking at other fit, young, athletic racing drivers, would think, I'm not going to be quite as good as these guys, so perhaps I'll do record breaking instead. But did you find out any reason as to why? What was it? Was there something that a personal mission he wanted to accomplish, or was it just something to do?
I think at Brooklands, I mean, he was a good racing driver. You know, he was winning at Brooklands quite a lot. He's sort of the best. I mean, he would win like standard races at Brooklands. He came first in class with Dudley Benjafield in the BRDC 500. But the point at which his life changed really towards record breaking was in 1935 when, as I said earlier, he was Sir Malcolm Campbell's kind of fix it man for the Daytona Beach thing, and he went out there and he just saw how much national respect there was for this person who were breaking records, and also he met his first wife out there, who was an American heiress who, you know, incredibly rich, and that opened up a whole new world for him, and he became, I think, he thought, oh, I can do some good here. It isn't just winning a race for himself. This is something which he could do wider, you know, for his country. I still think there was a very strong element of pride in him, in his country. And, you know, that element, which I think was quite common in those days and probably still is, but it was, you know, really wanted to sort of wave that flag. And then, you know, through his wife, he was invited to do all sorts of things. So he was the only non-American to take place in the first ever AAA stock car race on Daytona Beach. Wow. And yeah, and it was extraordinary. And this is literally on the beach, and where they cars were being bogged in and were having to be pulled out. But this was, you know, the precursor to NASCAR. And and then he kind of came back from this. And then this whole German thing happened where, you know, the Autobahn was extraordinary and they wanted to showcase it. So they invited him along. And so he went along with his cars and surrounded by these amazing, you know, Nazi war machine cars and all their power and money and everything else. And he just got out there and they went 207 miles an hour.
That's insane.
In an MG, you know, which was a streamlined car. And the extraordinary thing about it is the engineering is as extraordinary as the driver. Mm. You know, this thing had one set of drum brakes because they wanted to reduce the sprung weight. It had no seat belts. It's got no, you know, nothing else. He didn't wear a helmet. There was a 1.1-litre engine, and he went over 200 miles an hour 12 years after Seagrave went the same speed. In fact, slightly slower in a 45-litre car. And you know, you look at that engineering, it's extraordinary. And also the guts to just do that.
Yeah.
Which was amazing.
Should also point people that are listening. You're pointing at the cover because it's the part that's on the cover as well. So like, it was. I've not read the book. Is this his main car? He did lots of his land speed record stuff in, and was it his only car, or did he end up getting invites to do other things in apart from obviously the stuff we were talking about?
He did other stuff. When he came back from Daytona Beach, he bought an MG K3 with a special offset single seat body from one of his friends at Brooklands, and it had been quite competent, but not as fast as he wanted it to be. So he got Robin Jackson, the famous Brooklands engineer, to sort of make it go faster, which he did. And he did his first records in that, and that includes Germany and in 37, 38. And then it didn't go fast enough. And while he was there, the Germans said to him, this needs to be streamlined. You know, this is a big old beast of a car. And so he came back and he was a very persuasive character. And he didn't have a lot of money behind him. I think that's the other interesting thing about him. You know, he wasn't like a lot of those other ones that had tons of personal money. He persuaded Lord Nuffield to give him £1,000, which is a lot of money in those days, to put into this thing, which he would call the MG, you know, MG EX135, which is not too far away from here at Gaydon in the British Motor Museum. And the cover on it, the body on it, was designed by Reed Railton, but it was very, very similar to the extent that it was patented from a German design from one of the Silver Arrows. So it was a Paul Jarry design. So you've got this very sleek thing with quite a small engine in it, very lightweight, and him in this car, which achieved all sorts of records. But what he did was he changed the engine a lot of times. So what he would do is change the engine and get another record. So at the time, there were 10 different engine size records, and at one point he held 6 of the 10 wow. speed records, outright speed records, international speed records. So he was almost obsessive, to the point at which at one point he was he went out just before the war. He went out just under 1100 cc, and then his engineers that night took the head off, bored the piston liners in situ. Wow. Out, so for another sort
amazing.
Of 20 cubic centimetres, and then he went back out the next day and beat the next record by having a slightly larger engine. So, you know, he was very good at getting these records.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Driven Chat Podcast.
I mean, one of my questions I've got, and I feel like there's probably not a right answer to this, is, you know, researching everything you have, what's been your favourite story? But all of the things you've said so far sound like they could very easily be your favourite story. They all sound so fantastic. I mean, have you got a favourite story of something that you found out? Or is it something you've already spoken about?
Oh, that's a really hard one. There's so many different ones. I think probably my favourite one. I always love a human story, mm-hmm. and my favourite thing of the whole research has really been his relationship with his two engineers, his two chief engineers, and that was Reg Jackson, no relation to Robin Jackson, and Sid Enover, and those two. Anybody who knows like early MG history will know that those two were pretty much responsible for everything from the M-type midget all the way through to the MGB. And, you know, they were absolutely critical. And they stuck with him. And I think that was one of the things that the judge of the man wasn't how he was on camera. It was actually his engineers stuck with him to the extent that they even took time off work when he wasn't sponsored by MG. They would take time off work and go over and still help him out. And that his relationship with them, when you get the photographs of him with them, there's a great photograph of him in a taverna in Italy in 1946, where he went out there to try and do another record. And the Autostrada was awful. I've got these photographs of these potholes and all sorts of things. And but there's a photograph of them in a taverna and they're all laughing and he's got his arm around a waitress. And it's just this, you haven't got this grim face guy. You've got this person who's really comfortable in that environment. Mm. The other judge of the guy was, I found a letter from one of his soldiers that had served with him in the First World War. And he'd sent it to him mid-30s. And it says, oh, you were always known as this sort of firm but fair person. And at the end of the letter, he's basically asking him for money. Mm. And the fact that he kept that letter, I mean, it does suggest he probably did give him some money. But also, I thought that was really nice. He didn't just like screw it up and throw it in the bin. So there are all those like little elements of, actually, I really like this guy. And I think it's a biographer's fear is that you'll get to the end and you go, oof, I don't like, you know, I'm not really comfortable with that. But
I mean, that's literally one of my last question I wrote down was, how has your perspective of Goldie changed from when you first find out to the end of the book? So it sounds like it's changed for the positive rather than the scary one of I don't like this person.
Yeah, definitely. I think also my respect for him, I've driven his K3. I've sat inside his first record car, his K3007. I've driven a C-type, blown C-type midget, and it's bloody terrifying. All of those things are terrifying. And he did that, you know, not at the speeds I was going, but more than triple the speeds I was going. And I think the big judge, one of the people who got a pre-release copy to review was Richard Noble. And he said, you know, his words, he said, this guy was extraordinarily brave. And he'd been told by Stirling Moss, you know, Stirling Moss was also driving streamlined midgets at Bonneville a few years after Goldie. And Stirling Moss considered Goldie to be one of the bravest people he knew. And, you know, for that sort of thing, I think that just what he did, and also given his lack of money, his physical disabilities, was quite extraordinary. So yeah, I'm a complete fan. You know, it was I think the other thing which has been absolutely lovely in this whole process is meeting all the families.
Yeah. Mm.
So Roz, his daughter, so she was a very late birth for him. So she was born in 46, and she got very affected by his death because it was not a nice death. You know, it went on for a long, long time. And when I first started talking to her, she was very reticent about talking about the detail. And she actually said, I don't remember anything about my father. And actually she did remember a lot. And it took her a long time, I think, for it to come out. And that was really special for me because I don't believe she'd shared any of that before with anybody. So there was that. And also Jacko Jackson, Reg Jackson, his granddaughter, Tracy Rose, gave me complete access to all of his stuff and then talked about, you know, family reminiscences about what had happened. He worked at a place called Milne & Russell, where he was a director. It was a car dealership. And the sort of chief there, his son, again, gave me access to all that, talked about, you know, what his parents could remember about Goldie. And it's all that kind of, I love all of that. Whereas that getting to know people through a story, it's been really special.
Yeah, I can imagine for the family as well to be able to see this story told for the first time, because there must be so many unanswered questions.
Yeah,
and if he was as coy about writing about his escapades in his own autobiography, you can imagine that around the dinner table it was probably even less so.
Absolutely.
He wouldn't have wanted to share certain things. So it must be fascinating, and I'd be, you know, fascinated to hear that reaction from the family now once they get the opportunity to read the book and go, blimey, you know, granddad was an incredible man. Or,
it's amazing. So Roz and her cousin, Robert Gardner, are the only two surviving direct relatives. And Robert, it's interesting because I sent him a couple of early chapters of the book, and he'd paid a researcher a few years ago to sort of find out what had happened in the war. And he said, oh my God, I've learned more in the first couple of chapters of your book than I did a few years ago. And it's really lovely that I'm sort of giving something back to them. So, the other side of this is another reason why I'm doing this is the first book published by the National Motor Museum publishing arm. It's the first time, and the Bewley have been absolutely brilliant all the way through with their archive and with photography, you know, all of that amazing photographs. And tons and tons and tons of them. And I had to really, it was the hardest thing was thinning them out so I could just put the ones in for the book. But the most important thing for me is that, you know, the the reason the National Motor Museum is there is to tell the story of motoring. And that's what this is about. This is about telling the story, not just to motoring enthusiasts, but to wider than that. It's like, this is a fascinating period of our history, and it's really important. You know, it's all about post-war growth. It's always about, it's about pre-war, you know, national pride. It's about people supporting each other, and it's a brilliant story. You know, it's a human story as well about an extraordinary guy, and I just think it should be told. So some of the money from this is supporting the National Motor Museum, and we're encouraging other people to
I'm looking at Amy,
to help share that story of motoring.
Yeah, it is. It's so true. A thought that commonly pops into my head popped up there as you were talking about the celebration of the man, and I think, and again, it's fascinating looking at the way that the public admired certain figures of yesteryear, and by yesteryear I mean that we're going back almost 100 years or so, versus modern day celebrations. And you think back to your record holders were celebrated massively.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, it was front page headlines of Malcolm Campbell, of course, I think is the one that most people will think of, and the Bluebirds, and the celebrations of those accolades. And then you go forward another couple of decades, and we were landing on the moon, and you humans were doing things that humans had never done before. And these people would come back from these achievements and be paraded down high streets with tens of thousands of people there waving and cheering. And you think about who's being celebrated in the modern era now. Is it somebody that ultimately got famous because they filmed themselves doing something that ultimately they shouldn't have done, but yet somehow that's one of the most celebrated, most loved personalities in the world? And it's like, what's gone wrong? You know, what's happened firstly to the bravery of people wanting to go out and celebrate these things? Because I know there are people out there currently, you know, climbing Everest with two limbs missing, and there are people doing amazing things. But the sad truth is, we don't really hear about these people in favour of pop stars that are singing songs written by other people, or it is another world to go, isn't it? This kind of absolute out and out bravery. And I've always enjoyed using that word, or discussing that word, when talking about achievements like this, because there is obviously a line, isn't there, between bravery and just sheer stupidity.
Naivety.
It's interesting, because one of the other questions I've been asked about this, and having, you know, I served in Iraq and Afghanistan, Northern Ireland, back in the day, and people have said, "Oh, do you think that they were like looking for the thrill and Bricklands and these?" And I don't honestly think they were, because it doesn't make you like it, you know. But maybe you get better at dealing with it.
Yeah.
And I think that what they could do was maybe be aware that this is a very dangerous activity, but be able to control themselves. And so when he was driving along the Autobahn at over 200 miles an hour in this car, and he got a side wind that pushed him sideways, but he just controlled it, and he kept his foot down. You know, is that bravery, or is that being used to doing that? I mean, I'm no doubt he was very brave, and the way that he was... you know, the way he managed to... we've got a mower outside.
We've got a mower directly outside the window.
Just in case anyone's listening going, is that the sound of a Merlin engine Spitfire taking off? No, it's a ride-on lawnmower.
Yeah. Which is now going straight outside the window.
It is going right outside our studio window, just at the
is
point
this a
of
point
talking
that we
about bravery.
Pause? Exactly.
I think we will. We'll have a little pause here. Whether or not this particular bit makes it in, we shall see. But we are going to have a little pause whilst man on lawnmower goes past, and then we will pick up in just a couple of seconds for you, dear list. Oh, no, hang on. Is he gone? No, Amy's now looking out the window like a nosy neighbour, a curtain twitching neighbour.
Can't see him.
He must have gone right ahead. Does the grass outside our window look mown?
This is the problem. Only one strip.
I can hear.
He's coming back. Yeah. He's on his return. He's on his return pass.
He's on the return pass.
Right, bear with us, dear listener. We'll be back in a couple of seconds without the sound of a lawnmower. And we're back. That was a very short second and a half for you, dear listener, but for us, we've had a coffee, we've been to the loo, we've had a little mid recap. But the good news is, the man with the lawnmower has gone. He's left some beautiful stripes on the lawn outside, but he has gone. Now, where were we?
We're talking about bravery, and seeing if these people were brave or not brave. But I, one thing that I've always thought is that when it comes down to if something's brave or naive or stupid or whatever, it's usually decided after the act has been done. So if it has gone well, thing, then it was brave. If it didn't go well, it was stupid.
Yes, folly.
Yes. Yeah. So, but no, that sounds like he was a very brave man.
He was. He was a very brave man. And I think, you know, his... So it... The last thing he did, aged 62 at Bonneville, was he pushed it a little bit too far. But it wasn't, you know, of all the risks he'd taken, it wasn't a great risk, really. I don't want to spoil the book, but he...
Leave us hanging then, don't you? Yeah. Don't have to explain it, Something happened.
Something happened. Yeah.
And, you know, he made a choice and... And but you know, in the greater scheme of things, he'd done much more dangerous things in the past. No, I do think they were brave, and I think he was brave in particular. But I think that you know, there was a reason behind that, and I think I know you were talking earlier about whether we judge people these days. I think from my perspective, I think we're a bit harsh sometimes on the younger generation. We, you know, you see a lot of people doing some pretty brave things. Both in cars and also, you know, in the armed forces, and I think it would still comes out. But obviously our safety standards are just extraordinary compared to these guys. Yeah. You know,
And the other thing I think on the bravery and safety and that element of, was it brave? Was it naive? Was it actually a bit foolish? I think given his history and what he'd done as a profession up to this point, he'd be very calculated. He'd be very aware of what he was about to embark on, what could go wrong, which I think is the most important thing ever. And I always find that interesting when I talk to racing drivers or motorcycle riders especially, you know, who will all say, we know what we do is risky stuff, but we have confidence in our ability, we have confidence in the engineering, we have confidence in the safety equipment we wear. And whilst the safety equipment and the engineering were marginal in comparison to what we have now for Goldie back then, he still would have had that process of, he would have had an internal checklist going, this could go wrong, this could be bad, but I'll try to reduce risk by doing ABC.
Absolutely. I mean, he was fully aware of the dangers. I mean, Brooklands, not, you know, surprisingly few people were killed at Brooklands considering how bloody dangerous the thing was, and the state of the track by the 30s was pretty awful. You know, there's lots of patches of big bumps everywhere, and you see, you know, there's the famous photographs of them going over the bump over the river, and they're
half
all
a foot off
all
the,
you know, and the other thing was and the tires were pretty basic in those days, and there was one point he was racing and he was he says he was clapped on the shoulder, and it was a massive piece of tread from his rear tire that had just come off and hit him. And so he thought, probably not a good idea, but finished the race, came in and just bawled, you know, just on the canvas. And that's what they did. They didn't know, you know, you didn't have speed rated tires to go 207 miles an hour. You just had the manufacturers who would try their best to make something that would go that fast, but it was all a bit.
Yeah, how did you test it? You know, there was no way. Nobody had a machine or a rig, you know, to rotate the tyre. Because I think it's something like if you want to calculate 300 miles an hour of road driving, you've got to rotate that tyre at something like 700 miles an hour on a rig to see what the actual forces would be, what it can withstand, which, of course, wouldn't have even been thought about back then. But the other thing as well, and I'm looking at the front cover of the book here, and the car, the physical MG... It's something I always like to think about, is the fact that we as engineers didn't actually really start thinking about, or let alone developing, aerodynamics until the 1980s, like properly. We had a rough idea of what was a streamline and what probably worked, but ultimately aerodynamics then was guesswork. It was, let's make it look slippery and smooth and hope that works.
Yeah.
And yet somehow a lot of these cars from this era really did work. You know, they
really did. I think the, as I say, this was a Reed Railton. He built the body, but it was a Jarret patent. And that Paul Jarret was an extraordinary person. And that's, you know, there's another story there, was that this is somebody who in the very early 30s, was designing these beautiful streamlined things. And, you know, a lot of people will look at that and think that does look very similar to the Silver Arrows cars. And it was, you know, that's where they were getting all from. And they're getting these extraordinary speeds from these cars. And very lightweight bodies. You know, there's this great photograph, I think I put it in the book.
You did, where he's holding the frame at one person.
And that's it, you know. It's so they were getting it then. What they didn't, you know, as you say, there was no computer-aided design. And you know, lots of the backs of these things were actually causing quite a lot of turbulence and lots of little things. But even bits like the early version of the car had a raised, I think it was a chrome MG on the front. Eberhorst said to them, you need to get rid of that. You know, you need to make that flat. Mm. And so they made that flat and it went faster. You know, all those sort of bits. So, and angling the exhaust pipes backwards slightly and made, you know, just another mile per hour difference and enclosing the cockpit. And so it was all proper engineering, you know, just trial and error really was
absolutely
a lot of it.
Yeah.
Which was, I love it. You know, my dad's a mechanical engineer and I've always been kind of fascinated in it, but not, it isn't my area. But how they developed these things and knowing what they knew, and they were absolutely brilliant people, really extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, trial and error. Which is something we don't really get the luxury of doing anymore, because there's already, before the car's even been modelled, somebody's done a data analysis and gone, that will work because and won't work because.
Yeah.
So the car just becomes what it should always have been. Whereas back then it was just a case of, let's try this. I remember having fantastic conversations with the guys behind the John Wyatt era 718 Porsche Le Mans cars, where they were basically bringing the cars back in on race days and duct taping or pin tacking bits of metal onto the back to make what would then be referred to as gurney flaps to see if that would alter the aerodynamics, because the drivers were coming in going, it feels a little bit like it's trying to take off down the Mulsanne Strait, and there'd be a mechanic going, oh, I know, let's just hammer this on and see if it works, you know. And that was relatively modern day in comparison to what these guys were doing back in their time.
Were there any bits that you thought, I'm actually going to leave that out, not out of lack of interest but maybe out of respect?
No, there were a couple of things which I wasn't sure about. Mm-hmm. There's one big kind of twist at the end, and I'm not going to go into that, but I wasn't sure. So I've offered two potential answers to a pretty fundamental question, which is, you know, enticing to read. And the other thing, and I haven't talked about this with anybody else, was whether he was gay.
Okay.
Now, it's really interesting because I
suppose... Because you talk about him being, you know, it seems to be a womanizer or sounds like that from the surface.
And the reason I haven't gone into this is because there's nothing to back it up. This was something that came out of a conversation with his daughter, and she put it forward as a possibility. But it's one of those really strange things, because he, on the one hand, he had a succession of very young, very beautiful, a lot younger than him, and very eligible women in his life. But then there's the other element of they hardly ever went to any of his races or his records. I mean, only his one girlfriend went to something in Germany, and his wife and daughter, Roz, went to something in 1948 with the Jaguar, when the Jaguar engine car was in Belgium. And everything else, they weren't allowed to go with him. And there are photographs of him being much more tactile with men than he was with women. With the women, he was like standing next to them. Whereas with the men, he was like arm in arm and things like that. But I didn't go there because are we just putting our modern, norms on that? And was that just normal? Because he had a friend called Freddie Clifford who went everywhere with him. And I don't know. And so this was something that I haven't put in the book at all. So that was the only thing, really.
Interesting.
And I think also it is, although it is written to be accessible and to be a, you know, story, mm-hmm. and to explain where, you know, what it feels like, because I've driven old cars, this is my job, and I've been in the army, so I've been shelled and things like that, not as much as him, obviously, but I've kind of tried to explain what it's like, mm-hmm. and what it smells like and feels like, and, you know, to drive a car fast and an old car. And but what it also is a history. So what I've tried really hard not to do is to make anything up. Mm. And it's so there are elements where I would love to have put more in about the Coates mission, about, you know, because that's a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
But I just can't find any more about it. And maybe somebody will in the future and will be able to write more about that. But so I've kind of drawn the line with, as you have to as a biographer, you've got to make sure that you can write it in an interesting way, but you've just got to be,
you can't romanticize the fantasy of what could have been.
It's very easy to do that.
Yeah. Oh God, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think lots of writers fall victim to it, and it's not, you know, I know why it happens, and I think it's something I'd probably stumble over. Is the idea that you could romanticise a story that's already quite exciting, but make it even better because, well, maybe this was going to happen.
And
you can't, because, as you say, at that point, it goes from being a biographical, historically perfect book to something that maybe is a bit wild.
Absolutely. And there's elements of it which... so, for example, when I was writing about the First World War, and there's an incident right in the beginning of the book where he is being shelled. Mm. And his company, his battery had been shelled. And there's elements in there which, I've written it, but all of those are tied in from other things. So it was the point at which he won his military cross. So there's his, you know, the write-up for his military cross. So that explains what happened. You've then got all the records from his, you know, that his unit wrote after the event. So said who was injured, where they were injured, how they were injured, and that. And then also elements like I talk about one of his most capable non-commissioned officer. Well, I know he was the most capable one because he was the one that got promoted. Yeah. And, you know, in the next, he was the one that was always there with him. And, you know, there's got to be that. You've got to be true to what's there. I think it's fair enough for me to put my, and I did it at the end. I sort of talked about the legacy of Goldie Gardner. I put my spin on it, and also the impact it had on me, because I ended up buying one of his cars completely by accident. I shouldn't have done that, but
these things happen.
Yeah, these things happen. You know, so I'm a, you know, it's been quite a big journey with me, but you've got to keep it. You got to keep it real. Mm. I think one of the things that, as a National Motor Museum publication as well, is that, you know, this has to stand alone. It has to do two things. It's got to tell the story of motoring, but it's also got to be of use to future generations of historians. Yeah. And I think that what I've tried to do is keep a lot of notes in for people like us who are a bit more nerdy about the. And I've got lots and lots of information in annexes at the back. So you can go every race that I've managed to find, every record, speeds, cars, all sorts of stuff. And even since it's been to the printers, I've found more information. Really? It's really annoying, but, you know.
Well, that's for later editions to come
Absolutely.
Out. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I suppose the last thing I want to ask them really is, have you got the next story that you're planning on who to write about or what to write about? Or are you just getting this one totally out of the way first? And
no,
then...
I haven't intentionally, because I didn't realise when I generally write for magazines and online. And it's great because you write your bit, you send it off to somebody, they go, yep, fine. And then it's published and I have no idea how that happens.
Yeah.
And it's great. This was completely different. So once I'd finished writing, I was like, oh, good, done it, done my bit. I was like, no, only just starts. So you've then got indexing, you've got to work with the designers. I mean, I absolutely love the design of this book, and it's been really important to me. And actually, is for me to be involved so much in the design. And James Brister, Beanway, I've got to call him out. He was the designer of the book. absolutely brilliant. And he came up with some absolutely brilliant sort of little elements, which I just love all the way through. And some of them he'd been sort of showing me. I'm like, oh my God, what are you doing? You know, at one point he made all the, like, the actual black and white photograph yellow. He was like, no, it's going to really stand out. I was like, yeah, but it's a little bit too far. but then he's brought out those elements, which I loved. Maisie Minette, who was a cartographer and has made all the maps, brilliant, you know, and that sort of thing. I've loved it. But then there's this sort of thing, you know, it's trying to get it out there and get people to know about it. The indexing. I had no idea how complicated indexing was. And proofreading. You can read something 17 times, damn. You give it to somebody else and they go, oh, you've spelt Seagrave wrong all the way through. I was like, no, how have I done that? And then you go back and correct it in time, luckily. Thanks, Richard Noble, for that one.
he said through gritted teeth.
Oh, my God. No, I mean, my God. And blinking spell check. But no, it's been a lot of work, but it's been, I want to get this one out of the way first. I think there are interesting stories out there. I think all of that previous generation, so previous generation now, but George Easton was another fascinating guy. There's, you know, a lot's been written about Campbell, obviously, Seagrave's 45-litre Sunbeam, you know, that's being restored now by the National Motor Museum. So there's a story in there. There'll be something that will pop up, but I want to get this one calm back in my life first. Yeah. And I think, you know, sort of get to know my wife again.
Yeah, you've got family, kids as well, yeah. So get to see them again.
You know, going back to the old National Motor Museum and what its story is, you know, I think that for me, the heritage of motoring in all its forms, from engineering to accomplishments like this, really important that we tell that story in an engaging way. And we do it in a, you know, this is intentionally priced at £20. So it's nice and cheap, and you can, not cheap, but, you know, you can buy it. It's not going to put people off as a book. And that's intentional. So we get that story of motoring out there. And I think we need to, you know, we're in a tricky position. Motoring, especially internal combustion engines, are coming under much more stress from people's, you know, looking at them and criticizing. And we need to say, no, as part of our national heritage, this is really important. Mm-hmm. And, yes, yeah. You know, cars have created so much freedom for the individual person, more than probably anything else in history. And there were some extraordinary people along the way who did some amazing things. And that's why we should tell that story.
You're right.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, important question. And the call to action for our dear listener is, where do we go to? Because at the time that this episode goes out, the book isn't out yet, but a couple of weeks it will be. But you can pre-order.
You can. All good bookshops is the good thing to say. It comes out on the 31st of August 2023. You can pre-order it on Amazon, or you can pre-order it through my website, which is johnmayhead.com, johnmayhead. My pre-orders will be fulfilled by the National Motor Museum. So if you want to, those will be sent direct, and they will get more money. Put it that way.
Perfect. So that's the link you'll find in the bio.
That's the one you'll find in the bio. But then there's the other element of it. If you go on Amazon, I don't mind that at all, because then that pushes up the, you know, all the algorithms and all that malarkey. So wherever you want to do it. And if you're at the Revival, we are doing an official launch at the Revival on the National Motor Museum stand. Great. You can see my little MGTC, which used to belong to him, and we got some brilliant photographs of him in it and with it and test running routes in it and things like that in 1946. And you can meet me, and I'll sign your book for you happily. So come on the stand at the Revival if you want to. Perfect. Or go to Bewley. It's an awesome day out.
Or read the book, then go to Bewley.
Read the book, go to Bewley. And buy it from them, and they'll get
Have you been told the industry secret, but definitely not a secret, about if a bookstore asks you to come and do a book signing? Do you know about this trick?
Oh, no.
So if that happens, say yes. Sign as many books as you can, as many as you can. If 500 people are coming, sign 1,000 books.
Right.
Do you know why?
Because they can't send them back.
A signed book is a sold book.
Ah, that's again. A very good
so,
point.
Sign and sign and sign and sign and sign. Turn up an hour early, sit in a corner, just sign them all.
So what we're saying is if you get an unsigned version of my book, it's going to be quite a rarity.
Too right. Yeah, too right. Yes, dear listener, scroll down to wherever you're listening to this episode in the show notes below, regardless of when you're listening, whether you are listening in August 2023 or many, many, many years in the future. The links should still be relevant there. So, pop down there. You'll see the link to go through to buy the book or pre-order the book if you're listening as one of our early listeners. I personally can't wait to read it. I think this is going to be genuinely brilliant. And I think we joked before we hit the record button, like Amy was saying about, you know, Christmas presents. I'm thinking about, like, my dad is going to love
this.
No,
I texted John last night being like, hey, tomorrow, can you bring a copy? And because I'm gonna get this for Will or something. So yeah. Will, it's as a Christmas present now you know about. And he's like, they're not printed yet. But very easy.
It's
so
just brilliant. Yeah, absolutely
brilliant. Well, thank
can't
you.
Wait.
Thank
to,
you so much for coming in.
thank you for having me. It's been fantastic fun again.
Yeah,
really enjoyed it.
Good. See you at Goodwood.
Oh,
I'm going to come along to the stand.
I'm going to come along to the stand as well.
Yeah. We'll be there, like, two fans.
Oh, God, there's John.
Perfect. Right, call to action for you, dear listener, beyond going and buying that book, which you're probably already doing now, well done, is don't forget to subscribe to the podcast platform that you're listening on, because this might be the first time you're listening to us. So if it is, welcome. There are quite a few episodes for you to catch up on now, similar conversations just like this. There is also a previous conversation with John that you can go back and listen to if you're interested about finding out. I think I titled it I still can't, can I afford an F40 yet, I think is what I titled the episode as.
Still no.
Spoiler alert is no. Interestingly, the market values haven't crashed. Can't really work out why, but there is a fantastic additional podcast that you can hear if you've enjoyed the sound of John's voice. You can listen to that one as well, where we talk about exactly that. Why are certain cars going up in value and certain cars not? And a fascinating insight on how to avoid insider market trading, thanks to Amy Shaw, who then was Amy Shaw, now Amy Haynes. She has had to change her name by law to escape the authorities who have been investigating her for the insider trading that she tried to inflict on Haggerty. Some of these facts may or may not be true. Go and have a listen to that. Make sure you are subscribed wherever you're listening. If you're feeling especially kind and if you've enjoyed this episode even more so, why not leave us a nice review, because that does wonderful things for us and our bizarre algorithmic system of things we don't understand, which is the chart system. Go and do that. And if you really enjoyed it and you think, hey, I know who's going to enjoy this episode, why not send them a link, because it's free and it costs you nothing, costs them nothing, and does lovely things for us. So thank you. Don't forget, you can see everything that we do at driven.site, including written articles, our back catalogue of videos, our back catalogue of podcasts there as well, and of course some news stories that get upfreshed every day or so. So lots more automotive content for you to enjoy. For now, I'll say thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And speak to you in about a week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
The Driven Chat Podcast, powered by Paramex Digital.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Oh, wow, you've made it to the end, the very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat Podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven Podcast in your preferred podcast app or head on over to the website driven.site to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.